Welcome to another episode of Money for Nothing, the podcast about music and capitalism. I'm Saxon Baird with Sam Backer as always. Sam, the war is over. The troops are coming home. That's right. We're talking about rat beef. Just kidding. Rap beefs. I don't know. I thought it'd be funny if I said rat beefs. Yeah. So obviously I'm referring to rat beefs. It's been the topic du jour of the week, really, of the month, I guess. Everybody's talking about it.
You have the month.
We really, I think, debated whether or not to chime in here. And I don't know if we're really chiming in, but we were chiming in a little bit. But we felt, one, a couple things. Like, one, we felt like some of the takes, not that they were wrong, but they were just maybe, there was some takes out there, some major takes out there that were failing to maybe consider some things that we wanted to add to the conversation. But I think also we were just kind of interested in like this history and like maybe even like the sort of political economy of like rap beefs in a sense. As you said in a text message to me a few days ago at the height of the Kendrick Drake rap beef, like rap beefs are kind of like the most rap thing in rap. And like I never really thought about that, but it has this like really long kind of, I mean, at sometimes tragic, sometimes very cool history, but it is this kind of weird sort of part of history of rap. And so we kind of wanted to dive into that and also sort of try to, I guess, do some critical analysis of like what's kind of like underneath the hood of the Drake Kendrick thing, and not so much like our opinions on whatever, like who won or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think that just like we saw a bunch of takes that I think like both, I think, failed to capture because they kind of treated rap beefs like they're this one thing. And as you said, Saxon, very much like they are a tradition. And this is, in fact, incredibly traditionless part of a music that has a really complicated and fascinating relationship to tradition, to the idea of tradition, but that they, a lot of the discussion we saw, we felt like treated rap beefs like they were one thing, which both meant like not thinking seriously about the historical specificity of like previous beefs, but also not thinking about as much about the historical specificity of this beef and why it is the way it is, and thought that like by thinking through what are the conditions, like the conditions of production that make this beef different than other previous beefs, can help explain or help explore really like why it captured so much attention, why it was so intense in many ways, an intensity that I think a lot of folks, that clearly the internet loved, but I think a lot of commentators didn't like. And it's very fair to not like this beef. I mean, there's a lot of horrendous accusations going around, but I just felt like there was a broader discussion that was like, this should just be trolling, and it's like, it's no longer trolling. And we were talking about this quite a bit, and we were just like, This is really serious for these people for a lot of reasons. And I think that some of that's personal, but some of that's like the personal as it's been structured by where the music industry is and where music culture, as a result of both the industry and like the broader like techno-social moment that we're in around it. Like it's just kind of a fascinating like at a like historical theory perspective, right? Mm-hmm. This fascinating moment where it's like both individual agency and like specific people doing specific things because like they're complicated human beings, and like broad forces of production stuff, and then like structures of feeling and how they shape and mediate between those two things. It's like a perfect case for like all of the kinds of cultural critique that we're really interested in. And I don't know if we're going to get to all of that today, but I do think that like that's the general framework of thinking through why this beef operated the way it did and why it developed the way it did and why it was so fascinating. It's a way of thinking through all of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that like on like when you, as I said, and you like look under the hood of this, there's so many aspects. Like you said, there's like a technological aspect. It's like also like the end of an era, kind of possibly, and at this really important inflection point in like music and technology and how we like engage with music. It's also like a debate about like art and like different approaches to like art and like
and
it's also about class and in ways as well. And it's like, and then like you said, like, yeah, like how this, how like feelings and emotions get caught up in like not only like the artistic expression but then also the sort of economic aspect of all of this as well. And it's just like this kind of perfect brew of so much more than like maybe some of the things that were being some of the takes were like, oh, it's like, you know, just PR, or it's like just like rich guys arguing, or it's like, you know,
which it is. All that yeah, it is. Can right, be
it's
true.
All true. We're not denying that. Yeah. Or it's like in an era of like misinformation, they're like heightening the misinformation, which like I also don't really care about, because it's technically like, I don't know, whatever, it's the artistic expression. It's not a journalism, you know, like, I don't know. But, you know, there's like kind of all these things, but like there's so much more deeper kind of underneath all of that that I think, yeah, we just wanted to touch on at least. But also, we thought it was a great opportunity to kind of like dive into the rap beef, the history of it.
Yeah, no. I mean, so basically, and I think that it's worthwhile to just like, before we dive into that history, like, you know, for anyone who is somehow truly not paying attention, this was a back and forth set of beefs between Drake, who's in many ways been the reigning rapper of the last 14 years,
long 15 time. Years, yeah.
Who in many ways, and I think it's like he's been so ubiquitous that it's been hard to like focus on the level of achievement, that no one in rap history has been this commercially relevant for this long, full stop, period. No one. And then on the other side, Saxon's making a face like you're doing the math. It's longer than Jay-Z. It's a really long time.
Jay-Z's close, but also Jay-Z had like a lot of, I think the better way to put it would be like, no one was like, for this, yeah, I mean, we don't need to like argue too much about this, but I would just say like, maybe just to clarify, I would say this long of a reign at such a prolific rate.
Yeah.
Because Jay-Z kind of had this, he kind of disappeared for a fair amount of time. There's gaps of years when he wasn't recording, and then he like came back with that Rick Rubin record and like everything like that, but Watch the Throne. But there was like a lot of time in between that before he really was like
ups and downs. And when he released albums that like no one listened to, and like Drake has managed to keep having hits. And on the other side, you've got Kendrick, who I think there have been figures, not like Kendrick exactly, but like who have similar kinds of cachet before in rap history. But Kendrick is very few of them. None of them have Pulitzers.
Oh, no, wait, it was a Pulitzer or a Nobel Prize?
No, it was a Pulitzer. And
wild era. That Obama era was a wild time.
and both of them, I think, are, and I think that this is kind of tracks and why we thought this was so fascinating in many ways, that I think has been again missing from that a lot of the discussion about this, is that like both of these guys are in their waning years of relevancy. Even if they go on for another 4 or 5 years, the bulk of their relevancy is still behind them, because both of them have been at the center of the conversation about rap and what it means to be a rapper for a really long time. So in a weird way, I see this as kind of like a dual King Lear moment, you know? It's like the power's not gone yet, but like the end is in sight at some basic level. Like there are no more hills left to climb. There are nothing else left to conquer. And like time marches on, to quote Metallica. And like
holding back my Metallica "Time Marches On" impression.
One of those lines, when you say it, you just hear it in your head.
Yeah, completely. I know.
So some of this is in many ways like a referendum on the last 12 years of rap music in a way that's kind of remarkable. So that's like we're gonna discuss all of that later, but Should we go back to the park, Saxon? Should we go back to the two DJs and two turntables and a microphone?
Yeah, I think it's time to take it back. Take it back to before probably many of our listeners were born, or were just...
Well, before I was born.
Yeah. Well, we don't need to talk about how old I was, but yeah, taking it back to the days of UTFO and Full Force to Mr. Marley Mall and Mr. Magic in Queensbridge.
So there's this long history of rap beefs, which I think is probably even pre-recording in some ways, right? Is that when you start off by having MCs kind of like go at each other in MCs and in many ways like as a direct emanation of DJ culture, of Jamaican sound system culture.
Jamaican sound system culture.
Where you basically, yeah. you have clashes, sound clashes, and really it's more about the sound system and like the business as run by the person running the sound system, and the MCs are employees of the sound system that are hyping up the crowd because it's like a team versus team battle. And you even have this like...
Yeah. Yeah, like
Cruz. And you even have reports in like early rap music. There's a couple of really big ones. And like Kool Herc has like famously like one of the, you know, original, the, you know, known as the godfather of rap music. Kool Herc has a better bass system. He like knows how to do it better, but worse rappers, and like wins battles because he's got the Herculators, which are his subwoofers.
Yeah, or like if you go back to like Jamaican like sound system culture, it was oftentimes about like you played a record which like no other sound systems had,
right?
At like the pinnacle moment of like the quote unquote like DJ sound system battle, which would be like, you know, you play a couple songs, then like the other sound system like responds. It's like, you know, across the way of the dance hall or whatever, always usually outside. So yeah, it's got a tradition that actually goes back, that predates hip-hop as a genre, really.
And really, this is total sidebar, but if you've never listened, like, it is 100% worth taking 2 hours out of your life and listening to, if you never have before, a full 80s Jamaican dance hall battle. My a personal favorite is, like, the David Rodigan Slang Tang battle. They just go back and forth for like 45 minutes dropping new tracks on the Slang Tang rhythm, which had just been released. There's a really good audio fidelity copy of that one too. Rodigan wins, proving once again that he is a specific kind of legend. Yeah, so there's this long history of all of this. And when rap makes the jump from, or hip hop makes a jump, and battling and other things, right? Graffiti battling, breakdancing as battling, this kind of competitive one-upping thing, which is also tied like to deep Afro-diasporic traditions and traditions of black performance. Folks talk about the Dozens, which is this kind of like rhyming insult game, clearly. Though I think that, while clearly important, like this is just one trajectory for like a number of strands of this kind of like, think about like head-cutting sessions in... bebop, right, where people were going back and forth and trying to blow each other off stage in solos. This is like a long-standing form of collaborative slash competitive Afro-diasporic tradition.
Completely.
And so when rap makes the jump to recorded music, which it does, you know, and basically if you think about like those really early, like the Sugar Hill Gang, right, basically you have one of those, the crews of rappers, though the Sugar Hill Gang actually were kind of made in the studio creation, but as a model, if you think about Rapper's Delight, it's basically all the rappers of a DJ's crew rapping collaboratively about together how hard they are and kind of implicitly challenging everyone else. And so in many ways, like the rap battles are really at the core of all of hip-hop recording. But one of the first major rap battles, and one of the ones that really changes how it's understood within recorded hip hop as it becomes more of a pop form. Yeah, as you're saying, is the UTFO and Roxanne, which is basically a UTFO early kind of electro slash rap group when they're not yet really sampling in a substantive way, but they're still doing kind of like electro style production. Basically, they have this song about this girl who doesn't give them the time of day. And then, and it's a hit. And then
We gotta tell the apocryphal
okay,
story.
Okay, hit me.
So, because it's so good and it's like so fun. So just to frame it, this is all happening in like New York City at the famous Queensbridge housing project, which we'll talk about again a little later. But apparently, like, there was a disc jockey, Mr. Magic, and you've probably heard of at least record producer Marley Marl. And apparently, like, UTFO had like canceled an appearance on a show that they were promoting. And supposedly they were like standing out front of like the housing project, and this woman, Roxanne Shanté, came out and like heard them complaining about it and proposed to them on the street right then and there, like, hey, like, why don't we like basically record like a clapback like song, basically like talking shit on UTFO as like a way to get back at them for like canceling this promotion. Okay, who knows if that's actually how it happened, but God, I hope that is how it happened, because it's like such like an organic, random way for this to happen. And like apparently they like went back into the house where they had like a home studio, and she apparently like cut it, the entire thing, freestyle, like in one take. Who knows? I love it though. But and then it basically started what's called now the Roxanne Wars, which you can
we're
you can
basically pick up from there. And this is interesting, and in some ways with rap battles going full circle, which I love, is that so they released a track. It's a as big, if not a bigger hit. Not that many female rappers yet. That. It's fun, right? Like, it's so the song is written from Roxanne's perspective, explaining to UTFO why she didn't mess with them. Like, she wasn't interested. They're whack, and kind of goes person by person explaining why she turned them down. Now, again, this isn't an entirely made up interaction. It did not occur. UTFO did not hit on Roxanne Shanté. they
did not even know who she was, apparently.
She didn't have the name.
Yeah, she was nobody. Yeah.
Her name's not Roxanne, but she takes on the persona of Roxanne. And then that's a hit. There's another song that comes back. And then basically there's this like mimetic discussion with tons of everyone recording. And this is that moment when hip hop is still kind of like their novelty records. And there's a lot of not very good rapping. But the point is that this was a way to like get a foothold in this discussion that was already existing. So if you were nobody, by pretending to be a part of this conversation or being a part of this conversation, you could get attention. And so tons of records are released from every possible perspective.
It's the estimates are like it's somewhere between like 30 to 100 quote unquote answer records, all like apparently all playing off of this once again fictional drama involving this fictional woman named Roxanne that all started because UTFO recorded a song about that was a hit, didn't show up to like some sort of show promotion. And then, like, basically Marley Marl and this artist, Roxanne, like, clap back. And then it just turns into this whole family drama. So, like, just for an example, like, some of the tracks recorded at the time in response were, like, Roxanne's doctor, do the Roxanne, the parents of Roxanne, I'm the real little Roxanne, like, Ice Roxanne, Roxanne's a man, the final word, no more Roxanne. And these are just, like five of, like, 100 of different records that came out in response to this entirely fictional music rap family drama basically.
And so basically it's like collaborative collective flexing, a weird way is a little bit and this is one of those funny circles, right? So in this moment rap is hyper localized. There's a lot of indie record pressing. This is probably like the peak of the ability to make and press when the ability to get stuff on physical media was the big choke point for releasing music, but also like the height of there being a lot of ways to do that, especially in kind of a localized music economy as deep as Black New York was, where there's a lot of small scale record companies and indie labels. And so in a weird way, it's a little bit like, and we can talk about this later, but like in a full circle way, this beef looks a little bit more like social media beef in that like everyone's able to jump on and get clout from engaging with a beef, except in this case, instead of actually having two real people, or at least imagined versions of two real people. It's entirely imagined.
Yeah, which makes it like really kind of fun in many ways. And unfortunately, like, I think from here the beefs get increasingly more personal and more violent. It would be pretty cool to, and I'm curious if it would even have, if it could even happen nowadays, but it would be pretty cool to have a completely imaginable, like, a completely imagined, yeah, fictional, like, random answer records about some fictional drama. Maybe, I would definitely enjoy that.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, there is, like, you know, Drake is an imagined figure in many ways. So a lot of
There is all that too. Sure, right. I mean, like, and that's why I do think that is important to remember. This is like an art form, and like, I don't, like I said earlier at the top of the show, I don't really put too much stock into the fact that like some of these claims made by both Kendrick and Drake are exaggerated or like lack a sort of foundational truth, because that kind of neither here nor there when you're just talking shit on someone. And you're also, it is like, let's not forget, it is art. And like, I think it's a slippery slope when you start claiming, as we see in the Young Thug case, when you start claiming that lyrics are, yeah, like actually like describing real life.
Definitely. And so like, maybe the next big beef that we want to talk about is the Battle of the Bridge, which does get more personal but still has some of these elements. And I think both of these, I would kind of say, like, if we think about like multiple stages of rap beef, that this is, I would call, like, stage one lyrical jousting, like very much the kind of older school form of like demonstrating verbal dexterity, but on record and via records. And as rap is increasingly figuring out how to take this very free form, incredibly copyright infringing style, the most postmodern thing built out of boasts and recycled records, how you turn that into something that's legible and commercially viable within the music industry. And so one of those transition points, again, is this Battle of the Bridge. So MC Shaan releases a track called The Bridge, which is about how cool Queen's Bridge is, and actually doesn't claim in the song that Queen's Bridge invented rap music. Like, doesn't claim it, but makes enough of a claim that Boogie Down Productions, which is the kind of the, I think there's some other people, but really driven by KRS-One and the dearly departed Scott LaRock, who's one of the kind of major innovative early rap producers who died tragically really, really young. And Boogie Down Productions responds, and MC Shaan responds, Boogie Down Productions responds, claiming that rap is invented famously in the Bronx, the South Bronx. And this gets interesting. This is really interesting because in some ways these are more clearly structured records. This sounds more like what we know rap music is. And while they start off like kind of repping the parts of their city, it gets pretty personal, and you get this interesting, and I think where we start seeing the modern form of the beef emerge, in that, and this is this funny thing about rap music again, which is it has this tie to this very specific set of social practices, and it's not just like a cutting contest. There's a sense of lyrical prowess being integral to an artist's image and integral to an artist's, like, and their hold on respectability and their hold on lyrical prowess being integral to their commercial success. And Boogie Down Productions pretty handily wins this with, I mean, it goes back and forth, but like the classic track out of this is, I mean, South Bronx, but also The Bridge Is Over, which is one of the first introduction of reggae and reggae style flows into rap music. And it had real career impact that MC Shaan doesn't, like, is understood to have kind of lost his battle. This really boosts KRS-One and Boogie Down Productions, And one of those goes on to be like a major rap figure, not exclusively because of this, but the sense that having lost publicly a rap battle is bad for your career in a really distinctive way that, like, I don't know, getting blown off stage as a guitarist doesn't have the same implication. That this, like, there's this special testing ground available to rappers where, like, the career implications really matter.
I think it's interesting too, because that aspect of it doesn't really stick around that often, that long, in hip hop. It kind of, like, once you get into, I think, like, the late 90s, early 2000s, and then obviously into this, like, Kendrick Lamar Drake thing, it's like one thing that a lot of people, when talking about this, are like, what are the stakes? Because they don't have those similar stakes anymore.
But thinking about kind of like from that structure of feeling perspective, it's I mean they I don't know, I think they can kind of have the stakes, or at least there's a widely shared belief that they should have this kind of special stakes. And I was trying to figure out like why. And one of the things I think that's interesting is that, like, given, I mean, one of the reasons why rap music is so, I mean, there's so many reasons that rap music is incredible, but I think that one of the, like, the driving, like, underlying dynamics of the music, it seems to me, and has been for a long time, is this, like, on one side, because it's a sample, in many ways, a sample-based music, it's, like, the most musically one of the most musically radical forms of all time. You can fit any sound in a rap song and make it hit. Right? Like, so, like, the whole world is its oyster. And on the other hand, there's this tie to a very specific set of social and cultural dynamics that are tied, that are linked to an understood set of historical practices that go back, like, to New York City in the 70s and involve, like, you know, these various other elements. There's breakdancing, there's graffiti, there's rap battling. And so I do think that one of the, I wonder, maybe, like, as this music gets further and further away from that context, while still, like, paying homage to it in a very real, very lived way, that, like, rap beef has extra power, because in some ways, like, you don't enter that arena very often, and people can go their entire career never having been in a rap battle, but, like, there's this sense that, like, this is something that rappers are supposed to be able to do. The only thing that's similar is freestyle. Like, rappers are supposed to be able to freestyle. And, like, there's no reason why you should have to be able to freestyle. But, like, being able to do a good freestyle is considered, like, the mark of being of legitimacy in rap music in a different way. And I think that, like, some of it's like an old part of the genetic code. And when you step into that space, it's making a claim for this long your place in this long historical lineage, and trying often to point out, to like argue that someone else doesn't have a place in that lineage, or has a lesser place in that lineage.
I'd like to emphasize you using the word legitimacy there, because I think that is something that you still is a topic that's being, I guess, argued, hashed out, beefed over between Drake and Kendrick. And it really does kind of, it comes down to this interesting sort of concept of authenticity and, like, legitimacy. And, like you said, like, you're supposed to be able to freestyle, you're supposed to be able to do, like, a rap battle, and you're supposed to be able to, like, write your own lyrics, essentially, which is, like, these are the things that, like,
right,
are kind of, like, built into the genetic code, as you said, of what makes, like, quote unquote, like, a good rapper or, like, a good MC. That's in a weird way still actually rearing its head in this contemporary battle.
Yeah, like 40 years later. And in some ways it's like, if even though that almost none of this is necessary.
Yeah, greater context. Yeah.
Like, I don't know. You know, or like listen to in a greater context, or in the way that rap actually works. Like, think about, like, I don't know, someone like like punch-in rappers, like RX Nephew or whatever, right? Like, where people are just, like, the way they write now is, like, they just do, like, a line and then a next line and the next line. It's pretty clear that they're not coming. They're not, like, they don't have the yellow legal pad, like, working on their rhymes. They're just, like, figuring it out line by line in the studio, because, like, the recording technology is entirely different. Like, completely. The set of skills that was necessary to rock a park in Brooklyn in 1972 at some level has very little to do with what it means to be a successful rap artist in 2024, except that there's this idea that, in some ways, partially because it's very hard to assess legitimacy, it's that this is seen as like the litmus test, and that in some ways the very distance from that space, I think, gives it like this added like totemic power.
Yeah, that's so interesting. But I do agree. It's like, I do agree with what you said earlier, though, about how like it's actually kind of separate from how actually like rap does work. You know, I'm thinking of like another beef, which is like the sort of that was entirely isolated on the West Coast between Eazy-E and Dr. Dre. And it's like, everybody knows Dre has like a ghostwriter. Like, it's like, everybody knows that, right?
Well, yeah, because every album sounds like the person he's most recently signed.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and like, we all know that, but it like, he still makes a massive hit that we also listen to and everything like that. So actually, it's not really how like rap actually works, or the industry works, or like, you know, like hits still happen. These records are still popular. It's not like us as fans are not listening to Dr. Dre because he has a ghost writer. It's not, but it still holds, like you said, this sort of interesting, I guess what you said, I guess it still holds this like totemic power in a sense, I guess.
So if we think about that as kind of like rap beef one, I feel like rap beef two is many of the more famous beefs that we know. And in some ways, again, thinking about the relationship between rap music and the music industry. And I would call this kind of like fighting over the spoils, and that a lot of this beef seems to be, especially the 90s stuff, seems to be about, you know, if we think about the history of rap music, is that this is a fairly localized phenomena that then explodes in popularity. And all of a sudden, with a fairly a limited supply of good rappers not quite a limited supply, but like connecting good rappers to national appeal, like that pipeline is not clear. Like, see some of the lower echelons of the No Limits catalog were like,
God damn it, I was just about to say that. I was like, are you talking about Silk the Shocker?
I'm actually not talking about Silk the Shocker, but some of the No Limits stuff they can rap, and some of those guys sold multi-platinum albums, and it's really Beats by the Pound doing real work out there. But like this sense that because of how fast this music explodes.
Don't you talk about Juvenile like that?
Never would. You get this explosion of popularity in rap music, first in New York and the West Coast, and then increasingly in local scenes. And I think what you're getting there is, as rap is integrated into a national music economy and real money starts flowing through this music style, because like a big rap hit can get national attention, but these music economies aren't like perfectly integrated, is like a very academic way of explaining like all of the small, you know, all of these, you know, small-time business people, some of whom are more or less honest, some of whom have relationships to, let's say, other industries, suddenly have all this money going through things. And that causes all kinds of conflicts, just because the system hasn't been worked out yet, really. And so maybe the most famous one of that, like the prototypical one, is the kind of like East Coast, West Coast beef, right? With Pac and Biggie, and which is really not that much as far as I can tell. I mean, Saxon, you probably knew this, knew the ins and outs of this better than I do, but not as much about between the two of them as between like their independent labels that are being distributed through majors.
Yeah, I mean, I think we probably don't need to go like too much into this. I just feel like we need to obviously touch it, that this is like basically like opened up a new era of rap beef, because basically, as you said, like hip hop exploded. It became like a major cash genre, gaining popularity all over the U.S. And like, yeah, like this beef really, yeah, it really comes down to these labels that are at each other, really, in a way.
And a lot of the beefs in this period of time in like are around this, like stuff that spills out of conflicts over cash money, which like famously is not always the best at paying all of its artists. And then people who get mad at people who are around that. And it's also interesting, though. I mean, I think that sometimes the like the prototypical ones are these national beefs that take on kind of national prominence. But it also happens a lot in much more regional rap economies as those start to really come online in the late 90s, early to mid 2000s. So you have stuff like fights among New York rappers in the kind of like a mixtape era. You know, you think about like Ja Rule versus 50 Cent, where 50 Cent like assassinates Ja Rule's career and does that again, kind of in some ways to get prominence. Or Gucci Mane versus Young Jeezy, where it's again, this is like all coming out of these are like touchstone godfathers of trap, and they're both coming up at the same time, collaborate on two hit songs, the biggest one being Icy, and like fall out over who gets the money from that song. And specifically, it seems like Jeezy wants to put that song on his debut album. Gucci Mane won't let him, so Jeezy doesn't promote the track in live appearances with Gucci Mane, which makes Gucci Mane mad, which means that, and then the accusations start flying about who gets the money from the track. And again, this is about like non-professionalized relationships with a lot of money at stake that then get expressed through these musical conflicts. And I guess in Gucci versus Jeezy, not just musical conflicts.
Yeah, and I think going back to this point that you said earlier, though, about how the genre really explodes, people are making money, there's a lot of cash flowing around, but maybe like the industry, the actual like rap labels and the industry, music industry itself hasn't really, the structures aren't in place to like make this like,
yeah,
things are a little messy. And I think that unfortunately, like even now you kind of, you still kind of see that because unfortunately, like, and you know, obviously we know a lot of these beefs resulted in violence and people's lives, yeah, being lost. And you even still kind of see it in a sense with, I don't want to say smaller rappers, but I'd say like rappers that maybe aren't so much associated on like the level, the big label level that, you know, Kendrick and Drake are on. And, you know, I was just thinking about, you know, Young Dolph, who I think was a very prominent like Southern rapper and unfortunately died related to something that was probably partially gang violence, regionalism, and but obviously like it was, there is like this aspect of it as well, of this sort of the rap game, and that's when like kind of the real life and the art started to kind of bleed together. But these once again are like labels and situations where like these there's probably not, there's not a lot of security, there's not a lot of the structures in place so people get paid correctly, and like,
and there's a lot of money at stake.
Yeah, a lot of money at stake as well. Like there's still these things, these structures are, it's still a little bit messy on that level. So unfortunately, yeah, you still do see that, unfortunately.
Yeah. So if that's like two, fighting over the spoils, and one is lyrical jousting, that kind of brings us up to the internet age, right? Where a lot of the beefs so far have been, I would say, like a combination between those two. You've got folks, you know, Nicki Minaj catching beef.
Fighting everybody.
fighting every single female rapper for like no like particularly convincing reason. You have, you know, on a smaller scale, you've got kind of like the drill, especially in the UK, like postcode war stuff, where like basically there's a lot of real and often very tragic violence, and that rap music and the ability to claim that kind of regional pride or hyper regional pride that you see in something like The Bridge, right, is still very, very, very much at play with people like shouting at like their very specific neighborhoods and threatening other people's neighborhoods. Though again, it's really important to point out that like there's many ways that you can express things via music, and the relationship between music and real life is always, it's never one-to-one. Like literally it can't be one-to-one because real life is not a musical. So
you're right.
And so like threatening violence in a song and doing violence are different, fundamentally different things. And so that like, I think there's been, and in very troubling ways, again, especially with Young Thug one of America's greatest rappers, who's been in trial in jail. Yeah, in jail for like 2 years now, while this trial drags on, with increasing like RICO prosecution based on like lyrics like ready to go to war like Russia, like
yeah, it's kind of crazy. Yeah, so weird, yeah.
But so this is kind of like the general backdrop of like there hasn't been a really, I would say, like a new model for internet age beef exactly coming from rap music, though obviously like with the internet, music isn't just music anymore. I mean, we've talked about this a lot. I mean, with modern social media, we've talked about this a lot, where music is like one stream in this broader set of like multimedia flows. And so people start like insulting each other in various other ways, and spaces for conflict. And that music is one of them, but that I think that rappers have found ways to insult each other on social media that is not necessarily resulted in rap beef exactly, but it's like beef between rappers. That seems like increasingly prevalent as part of this broader set that like you're not just a musician, you have an Instagram account. That Instagram account is part of what you do. You know, you've got
I think that's also like this really kind of, well, first of all, I just want to say that I think some of the stuff that we were talking about, I think, is also very much a part of this sort of like mimetic performance that is very much built into this history of rap and built into sort of like the genetic code, I'd say, that you were kind of describing, like the stuff about real life versus the art, or like the idea of like presenting, you know, this sort of like fictionalized violence or this sort of like rap beef, you know, zeroing in on someone else who's wronged you. I mean, it's all kind of, it's been going on for so long now that it has also become, I think, part of this sort of loose tradition. And I think that actually on that point about the social media, I think it's really interesting, because I think that once again, it's between two artists who have radically different approaches to rapping, but like their art and how they approach their art and how they approach this technology and everything. So like in regards to the social media aspect of it, I really think this is interesting, because as we're going to get into, like Drake uses social media much differently than like Kendrick uses social media. And Drake will use social media to do exactly what you say, to kind of create these beefs. Like there was like one example, and you know, Drake is a very, I think it's fair to say, it could be like very petty. Anybody who ever says anything against him, he immediately takes it to heart and reacts against it, no matter how much he's like punching down. I mean, like the most recent example I read was like Joe Budden on like a very middle of the road rapper that not a lot of people probably recognize.
But with a pretty big podcast.
Yeah, like it said on his podcast that like, you know, he didn't like Drake's record or something, and then like Drake came back like with like literally a full Instagram post shit talking on Joe Budden about how like Drake owns a 767 and this guy like goes on vacation once a year if he's lucky or something. I don't know, like some ridiculous shit that like, why do you even bother? Why do you even bother, dude?
Yeah.
But anyways, the point being is that like you don't see Kendrick doing that. And it's just these completely different approaches, not only to like the art, but also like these sort of culture of like the beef or like the rap beef. And then I think that opens us up into this kind of further discussion of like so many other things regarding what rap is, what rap can be, what like in regards to like all the sort of stuff we're talking about. Do you write your own lyrics? You know, are you authentic?
Yeah, and I think that there's very much all of that is very much not just the subtext. It's the text of this beef. It's why it matters. Is that if we take, you know, that this is kind of a referendum on, I mean, it started maybe as like a whole bunch of people insulting each other, or like Drake versus a whole bunch of people. What it pretty quickly, and for me, when it got interesting, I didn't pay any that much attention to the first like 2 weeks of this, but it became pretty quickly like framed as like Kendrick Lamar, who is, you know, one of the best rappers probably ever by many, many traditionalist criteria, or in a lot of people's like more traditionalist like visions of what rap music is. He checks those boxes with incredible skill and acuity. His catalog is like beloved, really is like the person who, one of the few people with the stature to make this really a referendum on Drake and like Drake's vision of hip hop and the role Drake has played in hip hop over the last 15 years. And the rap beef is this incredibly charged place to do it because it's this hyper traditionalist space, right? Like it goes back to the beginning of rap. So it's this like, it's not in the mainstream. It's not how people do anything, but it's widely still understood in this fascinating way as like a central proving ground for what it means to be a rapper that is instantly recognizable anywhere rap is consumed. It's part of like the like it's part of like the lore of rap music. Rap music is worldwide, and I don't think you could go anywhere where people are listening to rap music and they wouldn't know what a rap beef was, or like wouldn't know what a rap battle was. That's so clearly part of it, from like how you learn to rap and ciphers to, yeah, just like the legend of this art form. And so I think that a rap beef and going back and forth and trading insults this way isn't just like petty for laughs. It's like a symbolically charged space where like testing whether or not this approach, Drake's approach to rap music, is legitimate. It's a really powerful symbolic space from which to make, in which to have that conversation. It's not a normal space to have this conversation. It's like the most traditionalist space to have this conversation. And if you think about like how Drake has used that space really tactically in the past, it I think adds further credence to like why it matters, or adds further fuel to why it matters so much. And so, I mean, it's useful like to think, as part of the prep for this, I went back and listened to some of those like early Drake albums, which are really different than once Drake goes Atlanta, once Drake goes trap. It's really like John, and it's kind of interesting to think back to like who Drake was in like 2013, 2014, 2015. He's biracial, he's Jewish, he's not American, he's Canadian. He's able to move back in Toronto, which is a space that like is a complicated city that also like doesn't have a clear space in like the American racial or geographic imaginary. Like it's both cold and Caribbean somehow. Like that's very confusing at like
yeah.
With like there's all these reasons why that's true, but it's like it's very confusing to Americans, I think. And so like, you know, and does this stuff where it's both clearly he can rap. He's got a cosign from Lil Wayne. He's like tied to New Orleans, but also is making this very emotional, very like female centric or romantic styles of rap. He sings, and it's this kind of like shape shifting persona. Like it's moving back and forth fluidly between spaces and getting a lot out of the ability to do so. And then pretty quickly runs into real like questions of his legitimacy as a rapper in a way that he at least I think clearly felt the need to address, partially because I think that rappers who are seen as like fake or soft in rap history tend to kind of like those accusations can really dog people, and they can really undercut the legitimacy of their career over the long part. And one of the first ways he really, I would say, like makes that turn towards establishing himself in his masculinity, in his legitimacy, and both those are really tied, is in a rap beef, right? When he does back to back against Meek Mills and produces like a massive hit that like gets played at weddings. That's also a diss track, and absolutely crushes someone who came up as a battle rapper. And like then is like,
yeah, like has a lot of lyrical prowess and everything. Yeah, for sure.
Right. Is a very like traditionalist rapper in many ways, wins without question, wins that battle, and then is able to be like, no, I can do it. I can do it all. I can both make Nice for What or Hotline Bling or God's Plan, and I can drop records with Future, and I can drop records with Migos. And I can be in every part of this industry, and it's not a problem for me.
Right, and I think that that's part of the genius and why Drake is such a unique star, and why I don't think it's hard to imagine anyone doing it on his level again. But also, I think he's fundamentally also, I think, changed hip hop in the sense that you do see younger rappers who are also shape-shifting back and forth between like sad boy crooner and like tough guy, and just completely breaking down those boundaries and those barriers. But it also does bring up questions around like what rap can be, especially in relation to, if we look at like,
yeah,
on the other side, Kendrick comes out of this kind of more traditionalist, what we've kind of come to learn is common in hip hop, which is like, you worked your ass off, you're a lyricist, you come from, you know, an economically deprived area, you came out from the hood, etc., and like you made it on your own, you know, all these sort of things. There's a real legitimacy to your story, to your persona on in front of the mic, and you know, and you prove it through your lyrical prowess usually, or a very unique style in the case of like, I think, a lot of Southern rap.
Yeah, no, and has that traditionalist vision. And again, it's like using that as a perspective to critique Drake, because in some ways he fits a lot of those more those older school visions of like what a rapper is. I mean, so again, thinking about this, I do think that one of the interesting things, again, if we're thinking about like rap beefs and then in some ways the traditionalism of rap, I was thinking about Drake's career a lot for this, right? And I kept thinking about David Bowie.
The Bowie beefs. No, I'm just kidding.
No, I kept thinking about David Bowie because like everything that Kendrick is criticizing Drake for, constantly working with new people, constantly changing your sound, not being rooted in a specific like organic tradition, all of that stuff that like we in the general world of people who love David Bowie, like that's what Bowie is famous for, right? Like turn to face the strange, right? That your changes, the idea that you're a sonic and stylistic shapeshifter. And for Bowie, it's seen as like an artistic triumph. It's no one saying like, David Bowie, you somehow lack authenticity or legitimacy. It's like, David Bowie, look at all the different people that you can be. And in some ways, it's just this fascinating. This is a result of a lot of different, those kind of like structures of feeling. Also the very specific dynamics of blackness and black folks in America and black folks in the American music industry is like, there's a need, structures of racial appropriation and expropriation, like for all of these different reasons, but like an artistic strategy that's so viable for someone like Bowie is exactly what someone like Drake is being, it's seen as like his Achilles heel.
In the critiques that he's receiving from the greater rap world at this point, yes, I agree with that. But I also feel like in a sense he falls into it in a sense where like, I think the one thing that like is also his Achilles heel is that he's too sensitive in a sense where it's, yeah, like he could have just totally went on being the shapeshifter and like had a huge career. I think, unless, I mean, it'd be interesting if you disagree, if you think this is wrong, but I think he could gone on continuing to rap, sing, and just do that with and still be just as popular. But he felt this need, he constantly feels this need to like prove himself within the confines of this traditionalist framework, which is so interesting to me.
Yeah.
Because he is that shapeshifter and that is his genius, but he feels this necessity to sort of legitimize himself as like, I can do the rap beef, I can be the rapper, I've like come up, I've got the numbers, I've got the money, I've got the girls, etc. You know, this whole sort of like this very, or like all, you know, I don't know, it's very strange to me where it's like, I think that's kind of where he makes his I don't know what to call it, mistake, but it's just an interesting aspect to the conversation that we're having, that he still feels this necessity to be accepted within that framework, even though he's actually, I think it's fair to say, a kind of innovator, a kind of once in a generation star who has like fundamentally, I think, not changed the entire direction of hip hop, but definitely like changed, or there's been an off ramp into like a different direction for hip hop that he's like paved the way for.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't, that's interesting. But, so I don't know. It's interesting. I do agree with you that he is in a sense a little bit like a David Bowie in that sense, and that sort of pop star contextualized, you know, in a music sense, like persona. But he seems like Bowie, never felt the necessity to adhere to, like, I don't know, rock star traditionalism. And like, Drake still feels this sort of necessity to prove himself within that sort of rapper MC traditionalist framework.
Yeah, but the thing is that I think with that critique is missing is that I don't know if Drake doesn't make the trap turn in 2015, right? If we don't get hard Drake on, like, if you're reading this, it's too late.
So I feel like he needs to prove himself in order to make the trap turn,
which has been incredibly productive for him. But also I think that without that, after the first three records, right? Like, I think that you start getting an increasing, I don't think he have this length of a career. I think there's a backlash against someone who's just singing if you don't make that hard turn after record three. It's too much emotionalism. It's too much singing. No, you're totally not real hip hop. That chorus gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And eventually it, like, he ends up like in a Ja Rule-y space, which is like not where you want to be.
But also, like, I'd say, like, it doesn't even need to, you don't even need to contextualize this within, like, hip hop. You could just contextualize this as, like, in, like, art or, like, within, like, music, where it's like you run into that album three, album four, yeah, you run out of steam. And, like, you have to pivot. And it's just, like, he's just, I don't know what you want to call it. Like, he's resourceful. He's, like, understands the business aspect of it really well, or, like, the pop stardom culture really well, where, like, he just, and I don't know if it's his team around him or he's, like, surrounding himself with the right people or whatever it may be, but, like, you need to make that pivot at some point. And funny, if you want to, like, volley it back to Kendrick, who, regardless of whatever's opinion, people's opinions is about his latest record, I think it's, like, generally considered, it's not a massive hit. It wasn't Damn. It wasn't, like, To Pimp a Butterfly. He, in a weird way, is, like, now facing that. We're, like, where does Kendrick pivot from here? Maintaining this sort of traditionalist spirit. And this isn't, like, an opinion on, like, who won the rap battle or that shit, or, like, who was a better artist or whatever, because I think we're dealing with two completely different artists. I think you're dealing with an artist that is, like, the one who, like, argues that, like, your hand needs to hold the paintbrush that puts the paint on the canvas, Kendrick. And then there's, like, the Jeff Koons where, like, I have a factory of, like, 30 right, people doing it. But that goes back all the way to fucking, like, you know, the Renaissance, you know? I mean, like, the Sistine Chapel was, like, 150 people who we don't fucking know their names. And also, I mean, you could say, like, even, like, Kanye, like, later Kanye record, the ones that are still good were, like, really a collaboration of, like, dozens and dozens of producers.
No, he's doing the Miles thing where, like, you get really smart people in and you kind of are, like, artistic director, but, like,
right. And it's like, I don't, so, and in some sense, like, the argument then kind of, like, I think you can easily, it's flimsy on the Kendrick side, where you are bringing up all these, like, really interesting, you know, he is bringing up all these really interesting aspects of, like, authenticity, but that specific aspect of it, like, if the authenticity is based in an argument of, you know, are you spilling the ink on the paper, like, are you, like, that it kind of loses weight, but, like, I do think there are other aspects to it as well, of course. Yeah, it's not just that.
Yeah, no, and I think that one of the other really big critiques, which we'd be really remiss not to discuss, is especially given that we're, like, a music industry podcast, is Kendrick's just critique of the way that Drake has used smaller artists hopping on their tracks, having huge hits with them in kind of what's seen as exploitative ways. And I think that's one of the interesting things about the way that Drake has maintained that balance between pop and rap after the trap turn, is he's got this clearly, him or his team, whatever, the entity known as Drake, has this incredible ability to find regional rap songs and styles that are both pop songs and fully rap songs, like Versace, like I Love Bakonin, like, you know, there's tons of examples. Romeo Santos, all these things were his ability to, like, the Romeo Santos is not, I mean, that's bachata, that's a different thing. But the ability, but then kind of using industry power to make that connection in ways that benefit him. Like, it's almost like he's this, like, and I think that Kendrick makes this argument. It's like, if you think about the music industry as a larger structure's relationship to Black America has often been finding specific styles, monetizing them, and then moving on. And Drake is, to a certain extent, acted in his ability to keep going as both a pop star and a rap star has required a constant stream of specific sounds that can do both. And in some ways, he's been like a micro record industry of just like finding people, collaborating them with a track, and then moving on, usually, in ways that are not often been seen as deleterious to their careers. I mean, so the other thing is, again, with that, it's interesting to think of both about Drake's career this way and about kind of coming back to the beef, about what makes this beef specific and different. Part of it, I think, as we're outlining, like, is about these two very different takes on what rap music is and what rap music can be, right? And I think that, but I think that part of the intensity of those takes and part of the how much heat is behind them is, I think, also a result of like the structures of production, the structures of life, right? Like Drake's ability to make, to do those, that kind of shape-shifting, to make those connections with musicians all over the world is clearly, that's an internet era phenomena.
Right.
The reason that Drake can be a micro record label, I mean, he's got OVO, but like there aren't that many artists on it, but like specifically, like he's a micro record label in terms of like finding people, releasing a song with them, and then moving on, is because of the internet, right? He's extremely online, his team's extremely online, and like you can hear sounds and easily collaborate with people all over the world because of the changing nature of production. And the flip side, I think, thinking about this beef, and maybe this is a nice way to tie it up as we look to like, not the future of rap beefs, I don't think there are going to be that many more like this, but thinking about the nature of beef and the future of beef and what is this moment of internet beef. So on one side, not only is Drake able to collaborate with people all over the world, but I think that one of the reasons that this battle, this conflict was so heated, it's because it's really long running. And we've said this a bunch of times, right? And I think it's really long running. One of the reasons why is that both of these guys are, and we've mentioned this a number of times, though we don't have necessarily have like a unified field theory for it, right? They come of age just before the internet really starts to shatter the ability to generate unified stars, unified new mass stars. So they have both been bigger for longer with fewer major people directly under them than would have been true at most earlier times in rap history, I would say. And so as a result, because they've been interacting at roughly this level since 2012, like as two of the biggest, like they were the two biggest rappers probably. I mean, there was an older generation that's kind of faded away, but they were the two biggest young rappers in 2012, 2013. And by golly, it's 2024 and they're still the two biggest rappers. So like the length of time that this has had to percolate without other like interlocutors is kind of remarkable. And I think as a result of like the unique position, generational position that like this fairly narrow echelon of stars that blows up in like end of web one, right? Like 2009 to 2012. Like if you were huge then, the odds of you still being really big now is shockingly high. And there just aren't that many other people. But then I think also like
because just to be clear, and what you're saying, because like basically everything's so fragmented now in the sense that like it's there's like
things are fragmented because things are fast moving because there aren't that many people who can
so that sort of sustained pop stardom is like more difficult to maintain.
Yeah, I mean that's what we've posited that before,
right?
And then on the other hand, I think that like there's. And the flip side of that, and this is maybe a pointing towards like the future of various kinds of music, I was talking with some friends about this. This is credit where credit is due. Friend of the pod, John DiCarvallo's argument that there's, because of how monetization online works, there's this whole industry of people who are making money off of having takes about fast responses about this, right? It's a mimetic feud, right? There's people whose YouTube channels are reaction videos. There's all this like meta
like content. Feed off of this to make a living.
Feed off of this to make a living. So the sense of like music as not just, right, people were feeding off of a beef to make a living or to have a hit in that very first beef we talked about, the Roxanne Wars, but that was an entirely musical phenomenon, right? That was used to sell records and get on the radio. And as music has become like, and I hate these words, like one content stream among a sea of them, right? And it's not just music, it's videos, it's Instagram, it's all of this stuff. And I think that's also reflected in the texture of the beef, which is so referential to this vast web of other stuff. Like, this is an internet permeated beef. This is a beef that happens entirely online at some level. There's also this, some of the intensity and some of the excitement is because a whole lot of people have a vested interest, not just because like they're fans, but because like their micro brands orbit these mass cultural suns.
Right, which is interesting too, because I think there's one thing that like also friend of the pod, Matt Jaihurst, like tweeted recently, which was about how this beef is reflective of our resistance to automated culture. That like, you know, there's like basically beef about the personal lives of like two people we're like all taking an interest of. But in some ways, what you're arguing, or what your friend through your friend John, you're arguing, is that like in some ways it's actually also completely reflective of this sort of technological moment we are in, where it's like there's all these like micro economies, whatever you want to call them, you know, that revolve around this kind of news and this kind of thing. There's like quick reactions to things that are actually that are happening out there.
And then feedback into it in this fascinating way.
And it's also interesting to me too, like, and this is a kind of a different point, but just thinking about the authenticity argument, thinking about that at the cusp of like the ubiquity or soon to be ubiquity of AI.
Where, and AI's in this.
Yeah, and AI's there was in a lot this, of... Because then also, like, yeah, because also like Drake also was like using weird AI, Tupac, whatever voice.
And people were dropping tracks when Kendrick was waited a long time. People were dropping tracks in Kendrick's voices, some of which were initially picked up as like, is this Kendrick's response? And then it took them maybe a minute to be like, no, it's not.
Yeah, so it's such interesting that it's happening now, like at this moment. And it just, the reason why we decided to do this pod, because there's just so much more there at this particular inflection point in music, I think.
Yeah, and I think that just maybe just to tie things up, it's like, in some ways, I think that this point that we've gotten to, right, where it's both profoundly new and means the way it does because of this lengthy history, in many ways is like, it's right. This is like the fundamental argument of this project, right, like of this podcast. It's like, understanding this long political economy and understanding this long history means that things happening now are informed by it, but it's also profoundly new, and that both of those link together in all these fascinating ways that just give these moments so much depth. And I think that that's one of the reasons why people are reacting to that, because it's both, this has a 40-year history, it has a 12-year history, and it's entirely of the moment. And I think that that, as much as the fact that, real talk, these are two very good rappers who are trying in like a in an exciting way, and like hearing these people try like quickly was exciting.
Exactly.
I mean, the all the really rough allegations, which we haven't really talked about, aside, because that's a whole other can of worms. I mean, and that's where you do get this blending of social media and rap, right? People would say that people did terrible things in previous hip-hop songs and previous beefs. And it was kind of like more clearly like, this is something you say on record. This blending of life and...
But now people can Google it.
Yeah. and that blending of life and digital life, like Second Life, and... music is this really, I mean, it's not the end of this. We're going to deal with it more, and it's really hard to know what to think about it.
Yeah. Please rate and review us and subscribe to our newsletter, Money Number four, moneyfornothing.substack.com. Music by Bird Language. Thanks for listening.